had a little task this morning. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means, subcommittee on Human Services, and it is Tuesday. Boy, this month is going by fast. May 15th, 2001. Public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2239. And I know that other committee members are on the way. So, and I know Grant is here, and Tom Johnson, and Dave Fager. So, Rick, we can start our conversation while the other members are en route.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, this House Bill 2239 is relates to the drinking water systems. I provided to your offices yesterday a copy of the fiscal impact statement and the staff ledger summary from the substitute committee. This bill would bring the state into full compliance with the federal laws and qualifies us for the state for federal funds, and the program would be supported by federal funds.
Chair Winters and members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Tom Johnson, the director of the Center for Environment and Health Systems within the Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2239 relating to certification of small drinking water system operators. There is some written testimony that is being passed out, and I really have only 4 points to make. And those are that House Bill 2239 brings Oregon statute into compliance with federal requirements. Second, that it makes changes which will avoid large financial penalties to the state. Third, that there are about 900 small drinking water system operators, systems that will have trained and certified operators, which we believe will improve public health protection. And fourth, that this bill is the product of a collaborative effort bringing together many stakeholders, and that it is a good balance of competing interests in this area and is supported by those stakeholder organizations. First, relating to bringing Oregon statute into compliance with federal requirements. The 1996 amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act required that water system operators be trained and certified. House Bill 2239 eliminates current exemptions for systems with less than 150 connections or operated by registered professional engineers. These changes will bring Oregon statute into compliance with federal requirements. Second, penalties are to be put in place if these requirements are not made the case in Oregon statute. For Oregon, this equates to about $2.2 million per biennium, per year. The state revolving fund is intended to make low-interest loans to small drinking water systems primarily to give them funds so that they can make changes to bring their drinking water systems into compliance with federal requirements. As I say, this would equate to about $2.2 million less per year available to the state to make these needed improvements, and House Bill 2239 will avoid this penalty. Third, the bill will require approximately 2,000 operators of small drinking water systems, about 900 of those small systems, to be trained and certified. This training will be done at no expense to them, and that's an important point that was a part of the negotiations for the stakeholder group. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency will provide about $1.8 million, a one-time allocation of money, to the state to go toward the training and certification program. We believe that this money will last for about 8 years here in Oregon, and after that 8-year period, a small surcharge to the state revolving fund loans will be put in place to cover the costs of the training and certification of these small system operators. And finally, and fourth, this bill is the result of a collaborative effort. Major stakeholders were involved, and those major organizations included the Oregon Association of Water Utilities, the Special Districts Association of Oregon, the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, the Multiple Family Housing Council of Oregon, and the League of Oregon Cities. A number of these organizations are represented here today and are available to testify if there are questions, but they don't feel a need to do so unless there are questions. But if there are, they are here. We want to express particular appreciation for Mr. Brad Frudge from the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, who chaired this work group, and also to thank Mr. John Brenneman, who assisted in getting this group consensus. Mr. Brenneman is here or shortly at hand and is available if anyone would like to ask him questions. This bill is not the preference of anyone, any one party, but it is the reflection of a fair balance of competing interests in this area and has the support of the major stakeholder organizations. I urge your support of House Bill 2239 and would be happy to answer any questions about the bill that you may have.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hartung.
excuse me. Tom, do any of the water districts like the Tualatin Valley Water District get involved, or would they be involved or have resources through here, you know, for those who are in favor of or opposed to Willamette River drinking water, or is this completely out of their purview?
Chair Winters and Senator Hartung, this bill does not really get at that issue. Tualatin Valley is a very large system, and all of their operators have been required to be certified for many years. This bill is really getting at much, much smaller drinking water systems that in the past have been exempted from the requirement of that training and certification. And with regard to the use of the Willamette as a drinking water source, hopefully this does not cover that issue.
You said hopefully?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. That's a different issue. To be sure, I'd hate to see this money invested in, you know, the proponents or the opponents for the Willamette, utilization of the Willamette. But I understand you say, I think, that they could possibly do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Use that. Okay.
Senator Yee.
Yes. Why do we exempt the small system operators?
Chair Winters and Senator Yee, the small system operators back when the certification program was put in place back in the late 80s felt that this was an unnecessary burden on them in terms of time, in terms of paperwork, in terms of requirements that they felt were just beyond what had been an accepted practice, and a practice that in their opinion had not resulted in great problems. As a result of that, they came to the legislature feeling that there should be an exemption for these small systems. Beyond that, we certainly have held the position for some time, as has federal EPA, that public health protection is something that should be preserved, and even small system operators should be trained. So I think, to answer your question the best I can, the small system operators felt that this was an unnecessary burden of time and the paperwork, and over time the balance has turned to say, yes, in terms of public health protection, there does now need to be training and certification of even the small system operators.
And Chair Winters, Senator Yee, if I could add too, the certification and training is not to the same level or degree as it is for the larger water systems, and the smaller operators are not going to be charged a fee. That fee will come out of the revolving fund rather than actually be a charge to the small operator.
I do have a question, because I noted in the fiscal analysis that you have been in the process of developing and training and certification program currently. Is that correct?
Chair Winters, that's right. At present, we do have training and certification for large system operators, and we have been working with this group to put in place guidelines to then develop rules for the small system operator training and certification. And as Grant mentioned, yes, there is a difference in terms of the training between the large system operators and then what we will require of the small system operators.
My question then is the need for an additional FTE.
Chair Winters, let me speak to that. Training and certifying 2,000 operators is a major task. And in fact, what we are intending to do, this one FTE that is called for in the fiscal estimate, is to be the coordinator to get back the certificates of training and to process them and certify them. We're going to contract out the actual training. This FTE will develop the rules because we will have to have in rule the basic requirements of the training and the certification. And this will be the coordinator of that and to make sure that the continuing education requirements are met, are recorded, and then the certifications are up to date.
I think your thrust is fine. I am going to, whether you looked at limited duration position, one of the concerns that I think this body has had in looking at not only this application but others, that your agency, with every grant application comes up, has an FTE in it of some sort. And so I'm kind of concerned about the number of FTEs for activities, but that is a concern of mine.
Chair Winters.
Is it possible that, are you talking about a permanent position or a limited duration position?
Chair Winters, yes, we are talking about a permanent position. Recently, there was an audit conducted by the Secretary of State's office of the drinking water program, and their conclusion, and it's one which we share, is that that program is very thin. We have not had any increase in positions in this program since the early 80s, and in that time, many, many more requirements have come down with regard to drinking water systems to comply with. We've met that in the past mainly through automation and through economizing, but the Secretary of State's audit, which we agree with, finds that this program is perilously close in terms of being thin, meeting the requirements that are there. And yes, we are thinking of a permanent position because this is going to be an ongoing program to assure that the small system operators are trained and certified, that they have their continuing education, is something that we take seriously, and is we're going to contract out for the actual training, but somebody to oversee that program is a full-time position.
We'll think about that. Mr. Representative Schrader.
Ms. Kenshin, we also have a work group that I've kind of helped put together with your assistance on connections and backflow. How does that relate to this? Would this be something these people be trained in also?
Chair Winters and Representative Schrader, yes, that's exactly right. The group that you're referring to is the backflow prevention or cross-connection group. One of the concerns in public health is that the plumbing systems that are established then that hook up to the drinking water systems, that there isn't an opportunity for water that may somehow be contaminated within the plumbing system some way to, with negative pressure, backflow into the drinking water system and expose others. Yes, that's an integral part of this drinking water protection program. And yes, the operators will be trained in making sure that backflow is taken into account and carried out in the way which hopefully the work group which we spoke about and will be acting on in the interim comes to an agreement with in terms of that relationship between the plumbing side and then the drinking water side, and they will get that training.
Follow-up, aren't plumbers currently being trained in backflow?
Chair Winters, yes. And I think what is being alluded to here is that the plumbing side of the drinking water system and then the drinking water system side need to be coordinated. And at present, we want to express appreciation to Representative Schrader for bringing together a group to address what now is some friction and some differing opinions between the plumbing side
yes.
and the drinking water side in terms of how those two different authorities and operations then work collectively to assure that the public health of the citizens is protected.
Representative Schrader.
I think it's important for the committee, and hopefully if there's some way to encourage a report or some of this work group, I think, to this committee next time would be appropriate, because, you know, if we're going to go through this training procedure, get the money to do it, it sounds like we have to do it. It's probably a good idea. But I would want the training to include the results of this new work group.
Exactly.
Because there's people out there that are thinking some of the stuff is intrusive, some of the stuff, the other side, people thinking, geez, we got to do more. So we have to have a clear delineation of who's responsible for what with regard to the safe drinking water in the house, in the system at large, and that sort of thing. So I really want to make sure, as this thing moves forward in some form, that gets that work group's work gets incorporated in that training. So when these people come out, they don't have to relearn what this work group's doing and say, oh, geez, I wasn't trained in that way. That's just a concern I have.
Representative Chair Winters and Representative Schrader, we would be happy to do that. You make a very good point, and it's one which we share.
I think we'll need it. Any further questions?
One question? I'm sorry.
Representative Schrader.
The cost to the different small town, small jurisdictions to have a certified operator come in and review their system?
This will be zero.
No.
Now,
okay.
The federal EPA has provided about $1.9 million as a one-time grant to us, which we think will last for about 8 years. And then after that, a very small part of the interest amount on the SRF loans will be used then to pay for the training and certification of those systems.
I wasn't thinking of the training. I was thinking of the cost of, you know, having it done. If I'm Canby, Oregon, and I've never had to deal with this before, The state of Oregon sends down the certified operator to check my system out. What's it cost the state? What's it cost the city of Canby?
Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, this training and certification is for, in essence, their employees, the people who actually operate it on a day-to-day basis.
Mr. Fager.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If Grant doesn't have any comments.
Chair Winters, no others.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dave Fager from DAS Budget Management. We do support the bill. We would make a special note that we have examined the resources relative to the Health Division in regards to FTE. We do believe that this request meets the requirement for a permanent FTE, although we understand the concern of the committee, which is also our concern, that we don't proliferate permanent FTE. This is a continuing program. We have looked at internal resources within Health Division to see whether there would be any that were could satisfactorily be used, and did not find any at the time of the governor's recommended budget.
When do you plan to implement the program?
Chair Winters, there are a lot of people in essence standing by. This was something that in fact was addressed last session. We've had an interim group working on this. We have guidelines developed. And as soon as the bill is passed, we will then start the process of developing the rules. We expect the individual, the person, the FTE, to be on board January 1.
Okay, so any further discussion? Representative Schrader?
Yes, Madam Chair, I guess I'd like to move House Bill 2239 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation with just a request to report on the results of the cross-connection work group and incorporate that in the training as we go forward.
I need to concur to see if LFO concurs Mr. Fraser's recommendation before I have yours.
Madam Chair, remember the subcommittee, we would concur with Mr. Fager's recommendation and with Representative Schrader's motion.
Senator Yee.
What about one limited duration?
The life so far has gone out to 8 years, and so 8 years would put it beyond the limit duration period. So it would be beyond what we would normally look at as a limited duration period.
If I understand, the one FTE is to develop rules. So once rules are developed, then you can contract out for training. So why do we need the one person more than develop rule?
Chair Winters and Senator Yee, these 2,000 small system operators will be trained, yes, in a big lump to begin with, but there is a lot of turnover there. There is need for continuing training and education, and they will then need to be recertified periodically to assure that they maintain that. We get a lot of questions. 2,000 operators, we get a lot of questions. We have about that number, just a little bit less, of the large system operators, and that basically takes a position to, on an ongoing basis, answer questions, help people who are wishing to become certified operators, to help them with their continuing education, and then to recertify them then periodically as their recertification comes up. There's a lot of going out and oversight of the people who do the training. We will need to make contracts with these training organizations. We will need to periodically monitor how the training is going and make sure that this system is operating the way it should. Our honest assessment is that this will take one FTE to operate this program on an ongoing basis to check and certify that it's going as it should. I think perhaps harkening back to the backflow problem, one of the things that has gotten us into the dilemma that we're in, that Representative Schrader is aware of and is helping us with, is that we cut that program too tight and that there wasn't the periodic checking to see what was happening in the field. And as a result, we got ourselves crossways with one another, with the plumbing side and with a number of other people, fire protection folks and whatnot. Our intent is to run this program as lean as we can, but in a way which in fact does what we say it's going to do, and that is assure that adequate training and oversight of these operators is there to assure that they're really doing the job that we say that they are doing.
Senator Yee,
how many people are you certifying now for the drinking water system operation? Can that be folded into the regular certification system without adding more people? I mean, you're only talking about 2,000 here.
Yeah. Chair Winters and Senator Yee, yes, that's a very good question. We train and certify at present just a little less than 2,000. And yes, we are using the same computer system. We're using the same process that exists already. It's not a duplication of that. We have done as much combining and using the same programs as we can. But simply, I think what we would say is that our honest assessment is, in terms of the workload that remains, our estimate is that there is an FTE to oversee the new work that will be coming, even taking into account the integration of the two training programs.
Another question, Madam Chair. So how many FTEs are operating the regular system now?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, one.
One.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add 2,000 small system operators.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schrader.
Just a comment. I'm obviously sympathetic to Senator Yee's position because that'd be my natural inclination also. Mm-hmm. However, in doing a little bit of work with this work group, we're trying to get it going. In the backflow connection area, they only have like a quarter, well, not even that. Well, they've got a 0.4 FTE to deal with this whole system and oversee all these various operators, and it has not been enough. And so to the extent that this one additional FTE can help with that, in addition to the training, and ongoing training that's going on, they need more help. Otherwise, we're going to get into more trouble. So they actually do need, I think, another person in this particular case. So I'm actually supportive of having the full-time FTE. I said it here.
it's
8,001. The camera's rolling, Mr.
You should identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my thinking is if we give them one limited duration FTE, and then they can come back in 2 years and tell us whether it needs to be permanent or not.
Well, I think given that, that the life of they're talking 8 years and out. And I think the other issue is that, you know, we do want to make sure that we are in compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. It is important. And then you've got the backflow issue. I raised it because we want to make sure that the agency, that it really is looking at positions and really is looking, because we raised it in other times when they were before us. And it seems to me that they have done a lot of background work, and they really have stated their case for the need for this particular position. 2,000 is a large number when you're talking both certification as well as talking about ongoing training and those kinds of activities. It takes a lot just working with people to get things through the system, so I have no problem with knowing that they're going to have, you know, certification for 2,000 plus training, plus working with backflow, the plumbers and what have you. That'll take a lot of time for the individual, so I'm comfortable with the position request, the FTE request, and also very supportive that we do need to make sure that we are in compliance with the safe water. I think that's an important issue when we think about how much water we all consume, and not all of us buy bottled water, and even that I understand may not be free of impurities. So, and unless there's any no's or any objections to their request, Cindy?
Well, I'm not sure.
You're not
so,
sure?
So why don't I go no now and reserve the
and
right?
And reserve the right? you can do that. Are there any other reservations today?
There's no need for her to identify herself.
Well, cruel.
Representative Schrader moved that we approve the request as stated by Legislative Fiscal to full Ways and Means with the due pass. We will note that Senator Yee is a no and reserves to change her mind at full Ways. And he'll visit with the agency. Are there any other objections? If not, so ordered. The carrier, I can't ask Senator Yee. Senator Hartung?
Sure.
Group this morning. Let's see. We have Grant again and Jeannie Arana and Mr. Fazer still there. We're still in public hearing and work session.
Chair Wenders, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the acting administrator for the Oregon Health Division Department of Human Services. And I am here today along with our partner from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to request approval to apply for a grant for housing opportunities for persons with AIDS. This is a HOPWA grant. This is very similar to the grant that we applied for last year from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. However, we were unsuccessful in getting the grant last year. We are hopeful that we will be successful this year. We first learned about the grant availability February 26, 2001. The application is due June 13th. If we are successful in getting the grant, we will get $1.37 million over a three-year period to provide for the availability of housing resources and incentives to provide for comprehensive strategies for meeting the housing needs of people with AIDS. Homelessness is an identified problem for people who are living with HIV and AIDS, and I think that everyone can understand that it is a critical element for the health and well-being of people with AIDS to have safe and affordable housing. The agency that applies for one of these HOPWA grants must be an agency that can provide for comprehensive supported services to people with HIV and AIDS, and consequently, the Health Division is the only state agency that fits that bill. However, because this primarily is a housing grant, that we are applying for, our primary partner here and the one who will actually be sponsoring and managing the grant and have all of the FTEs associated with the grant is the Housing and Community Services Department. And so with that, I will turn it over to Jean.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Winters, members of the committee. I'm Jean Arana with the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. We are here in support of the Health Division's request for the HOPWA grant, the Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS. The proposal is a balance of state proposal and addresses 31 counties outside of the Portland Metropolitan Service Area, where there have been identified by the Health Division over 1,200 individuals in need of services, supportive services for HIV and AIDS. The grantee would be the state of Oregon, but the Oregon Housing and Community Services Division, department, would serve as a sponsor along with four private agencies who are partners of ours around the state. Those private agencies are the HIV Alliance, which resides in the Eugene-Springfield area, the Central Oregon Community Action Network, which is the Bend and Redmond area and would actually serve in coordinating housing for the people living with AIDS for most of the eastern part of the state. OnTrack is an organization out of Medford, covering the southern Oregon area, and then Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency here in the Marion Polk area. University of Oregon would be conducting an independent evaluation of our program outcomes. The 2.5 FTE that would come with the grant are limited to the 3-year period of the grant. They would not reside in housing, nor would they reside in the Health Division. They would be out in the areas of the state where they would be coordinating the housing and supportive services for the populations there. We would provide the day-to-day operations, administrative oversight, and act as a single-source rental payee. This would be a voucher program. It's a brand-new concept, but it marries two state divisions or agencies and provides a service that is very much needed in the state. And we are very excited about the opportunity to partner with the Health Division on this proposal. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
President Gates.
Once again, I'm confused about why the Health Department is getting into housing. I mean, Health and Human Resources, there's other groups I could think that might work better for this. Again, you guys are being spread.
Right. Chair Winters, Representative Bates, again, my understanding is that the agency that actually applies for the grant has to be an agency that has a history and experience with providing comprehensive supported services to HIV/AIDS clients. And housing does not fit that bill. And consequently, we are the agency that would apply for this. We're basically then passing all the money for the grant through to Housing and Community Development. However, part of the grant is to make sure that those staff people that they hire that are providing the housing services are very closely linked with the 29 local health departments and all the community action programs that are involved and community-based organizations that are involved in HIV/AIDS services to make sure that those things are coordinated. So it really is we're applying for the grant, passing through the money, and then ensuring that the services, the health-related services that we are supplying, providing, are linked up with that housing component of the grant.
Representative Bates is shaking his hand. Do you want to follow up?
No, this is something, Madam Chair, this is something for interim work. We're not going to settle up this kind of stuff this morning.
Yeah, we've...
We have to look at this, and we have more time to relook at these issues.
Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, in the LFO analysis, it says $300,000 per year, $300,000 per year for rental assistance. So this is not to build new housing projects. This is to help them rent housing.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that is correct. the Ryan White case management funds that come through the health division, there they've identified that one of the greatest needs is housing for this population. And to think that we'll build our way out of the problem, I think, is unrealistic. The department has a competitive process, as you well know, and HUD funds for HOPWA funds are not allowed to be used in a competitive process. Other states have been identified as having some success in a voucher program where the housing coordinators work with the communities to develop acceptance of this particular special needs population and work to identify landlords that will be willing to rent to people with special needs who are undergoing case management. And the case management is a requirement of the program.
Follow up.
Is there any concern about this special group living with other groups? I mean, would it be very difficult to get housing for this particular group?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that has been identified as a problem, that the public perception is that there is a health risk to having people living with HIV and AIDS in an apartment complex, for example. But I think the health division could probably best answer that question about what risk that might pose.
And to follow up, Chair Winters and Senator Yee, there is no health risk to other people living in apartments nearby with patients with HIV/AIDS. But as Jean said, there is a perception that there can be a problem, and consequently it is sometimes difficult for patients with HIV/AIDS to find apartments. And so this grant will certainly allow us to do that better. Also, it's going to be critical that the confidentiality of patients is maintained, because that is something that people living next door to them really have no right to know.
Jean, what was the reason that the other grant application was not approved?
Madam Chair, HUD kind of changed the rules in midstream. We had submitted the grant request, but HUD was looking more at the refunding of programs that were already in existence, and this is a new proposal. We have a consultant who is working both with the Health Division and the Housing and Community Services to identify the possibility of enough HOPWA funds being available for this. And we hear rumors that there may be dollars available for new programs. So I think our opportunity this time is a little bit better than it was going in the last time we submitted this.
And Chair Winters, if I could add, my understanding is that we actually scored very high on the application last year. There simply was not enough money for new dollars to be funding new proposals.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. It looks like you have the U of O conducting an independent evaluation. Which part of U of O is doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, it's the community planning workshop.
Okay. Follow it. And then below it talks about an identified disconnection between providers of HIV/AIDS services and providers of housing services, and that will also be addressed through services provided by U of O. Is that a different entity of U of O that's doing that, and can you explain a little bit about the disconnect and how that will be addressed?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, it is the same part of the University of Oregon that's identified here, just different components of dealing with the grant. And the disconnect, and Grant has my cheat sheet there. I had my flow chart that I gave you. There it is. Thank you. The clients would be identified by the health division through their Ryan White case managers and the health departments around the county health departments around the state. Those people then would be referred to the housing coordinators that would be a part of this grant. The housing coordinators will have been working with their communities, the four regions statewide, to identify landlords willing to receive and to provide housing for these individuals. The case managers would stay involved with the client The housing coordinator would identify the housing and work with the housing community to make sure that that disconnect no longer was a factor.
And so, follow-up, so how's U of O involved with that piece then?
The University of Oregon has been, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, University of Oregon has been involved in the development of the grant, in working with HIV, the Washington group, AIDS Housing of Washington, in helping us develop this proposal, and then we'll be evaluating the proposal.
Okay, Madam Chair, I was just concerned because it talks about an independent evaluation, and then it talks about services provided by the U of O. Kind of gives the impression in the language that somehow the same entity that's evaluating is going to be then also involved in delivery of the service. So maybe that's not exactly what you meant when you wrote this.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, they are not, there will not be a conflict, so I apologize if it appears that way.
Okay. Smith, your recommendation.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending approval of this grant request.
Mr. Fazer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Dave Fazer from DAS Budget Management. We would recommend approval of the request and comment on Representative Bates' observation that perhaps this is an oddity in regards to who is applying and who is benefiting from the funds. It also intrigued DAS, and we looked at that exact issue because a suspicious person may look at this on the surface and believe something subversive is going on.
No, wait a minute.
I was referring to myself.
I defend myself here.
I was referring to myself, Representative. But at any rate, what we found was that the feds have very carefully crafted the requirements around this particular grant to encourage a very unlikely collaboration between housing and not only the health division in the state, because there has to be an agency that administers the grant, applies and administers the grant, but also the local county health departments are involved, as you just heard. And to energize that kind of unlikely collaboration, they've crafted the application process so that the health division has to be planning, executing, and answering questions on how these grant funds are to be spent.
What I find intriguing about the federal request is that normally, and I got to backtrack a little bit, normally if it's the HUD, HUD would kind of yield to Housing and Community Development as making sure, and then they would have the buy-off. This is not unusual, and I need to say this for the panel, because when we dealt with model cities, we had to have all of the agencies' participation and sign-offs when we did that very massive comprehensive program, and that was to assure the federal government that everybody was a player in the delivery of the services. So we had everything from HUD was the lead agency to education to health to employment. They were all intertwined, and so that does happen when you're dealing with the federal government, and that's to assure that all the players and everybody's at the table. So I can understand the intricacies of this grant application, but usually HUD has their own agency as the lead, so that's kind of a little different for this one. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a result, I'm no longer suspicious.
Oh, I guess you're not being in for most discussion. This has already been covered. I don't care. But you mentioned the program outcomes. What are the outcomes? Was that discussed? What the outcomes are, what you're trying to get out of this? What's the goal?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, over the next 3 years, the life of the grant, the Oregon Housing Opportunities, in partnership, proposes to provide 240 units. Primarily, it is linking that people in need of housing, special needs population. So we're proposing that we'll be able to provide 240 units using the HOPWA funds. But in addition, it creates, a long-term partnership, and the department is committed to the partnership regardless of whether or not the funds are received. It's an identified special needs population that is in need of housing, and we will continue. But the grant would allow us to develop those partnerships out in the balance of state area to serve 240 families with
Riverside.
So you're really not doing any outcomes. What you're saying is that the University of Oregon will evaluate whether or not you spend the money like you're proposing to spend the money.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, that is part of it. I did not bring a grant application, but we obviously are hoping that we can demonstrate a linkage that continues beyond the life of the grant, that does link the community action network, the HIV Alliance, and so on, those people who deal with the populations on a daily basis.
And Chair Wenderson, Representative Schrader, if I could add, I believe that there also will be some health outcomes as well, whether or not people are in fact linked to services that they should be linked to, and then the health status of the people who are involved in the project as well. And I can get you some additional information on the evaluation if you'd like.
It's just, Representative Schrader. Labor. We're just trying to get in the habit of calling things what they are. I mean, building housing is great and fine, but that's not an outcome. That's doing what you said you're paying it for. But that the other would be more outcomes. If it shows that we can keep these people healthier longer and provide them better quality of life, then that would be an interesting outcome that I think the body would like to have in the future.
And that could be an outcome that they could bring to us because they have to come back to the emergency board should they receive approval from the federal government, and at that time to have a clearly stated outcome. Senator Yin, then I've got to close off because we need to get to the floor.
One of the outcomes could be the people we help to receive housing who otherwise would not have received housing. That would be, maybe you can establish a baseline and give us a comparison at the end of 1 year, 2 years, 3 years.
Representative Patrick,
move. Madam Chair, I move the...
Mr. Fager, you already gave your blessing?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Now, Representative Patrick.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we recommend the federal grant application as requested by Department of Human Services, Health Division, and Housing and Community Services. With a due pass to the Full Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Patridge moves that we approve the grant application request sent to Full Ways and Means with the due pass. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Carrier, Representative Patridge. Although we're supposed to be having health, we, our four starts at 10 o'clock. This morning, I want to start at 10 this morning. So, if there's no other discussion or questions or comments or concerns from the Chronologically Advantaged Group and the Junior Group, we are adjourned. We're adjourned. We don't start till 11 today? Oh my goodness!
No, it's 10 o'clock.
I'm sorry. I didn't hit the gavel. Come back.
Now who's advantage?
Oh, I said I was going to advantage group.
We were caught up. It was hopeless.
Oh, God. Well, you know, usually Reverend Patrick shows up just
like
5 minutes before we adjourn.
Around the clock, Madam Chair.
He's walking just about 10 minutes.
I was the one who brought that up. I saved some.
Oh, yes.
You can bring donuts or something.
Well, I brought donuts this morning, you know, earlier.
Where?
Up in top. I'll have to remember to bring it for our panel next time. But anyway, I'm glad you saved us. You can tell it's getting late in session.
It didn't answer your question.
Grant.
Chair Winters, members of the committee.
I need to open you up, though. Public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Department of Human Services, Health Division. Now, Grant.
Chair Wenders and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the acting administrator for the Oregon Health Division Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to continue the program, the detailed program description in our budget request. Tom Johnson, the director for the Center of Environmental and Health Systems, is here with me. Where we left off the last time was we were in just about to the end of emergency medical services and systems on page 79, and what I was just going to finish saying on that program is that this has been a program, and particularly the trauma system, that has had national evaluations. It is a recognized effective program and evaluated to save a number of lives in Oregon every year. And with that, I was going to close on emergency medical services unless there were questions. The next program that we're dealing with is the drinking water program, and you've heard a little bit about this, this already. What we do is implement national drinking water standards. As you know, those standards include testing for a number of contaminants, both biological and chemical. The number of contaminants we test for have raised since 23, from 23 during the 70s to 96 at the current time, and those are going to go up. We'll be measuring, regulating over 100 by the year 2000. What we do is investigate reports of waterborne disease in this program. We require water sampling and reporting. We investigate any problems that are identified. We coordinate and lend money through the revolving loan fund so that in partnership with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, in order that communities can enhance, improve, or actually develop new community drinking water systems. We certify water system operators. We conduct periodic surveys. Are there any other questions on the drinking water program? And I'm trying to go through this quickly in the hopes that we might be able to...
What is the criteria for applying for this drinking water? Is it a grant or a loan?
Chair Wenders, Senator Yee, it is a loan. It is a low-interest loan. And every year...
Chair Wenders, Senator Yee, are you talking about the basic drinking water protection program or the state revolving fund? The basic program... That is one which is a grant that is required on a match basis. But in this grant, if you take it, then you have to take the full primacy program, meaning that you are the primary enforcer of federal drinking water standards. In this case, we have state drinking water standards too. And so it's a package. If you take it, you have to take the whole thing, but there is a required match, basically 3-1.
Madam Chair, what is the criteria for this loan or grant program?
What are the criteria for this? Okay. Basically, there is a group of criteria and priorities set by the Drinking Water Advisory Committee that oversees the drinking water program in general, but basically it is that small systems that are in financial difficulty that have problems meeting existing federal drinking water standards are those that this money is directed toward. So small, financially troubled, trouble meeting drinking water standards for safe drinking water.
Follow up. So they are unable to meet the standards.
That's correct, Chair Wenders and Senator Yee. That's correct. They do not meet standards for safe drinking water. Therefore, they need to make some changes. And if they are financially troubled, this is a means that can make funding available to them so that they can meet those standards and provide safe drinking water.
So they have to meet both standards. Meet the EPA standard as well as financially not able to?
Senator Yee, that is correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
How do you determine financially not able to? They can all tell you they're financially not able to.
Chair Winters, Senator Yee, we have entered into an arrangement with Oregon Community and Economic Development, which run many programs like this for community development. We are the ones that set the criteria, and they are the ones that oversee the collecting of the application, bringing the information together, which we then review to make sure that they fit the criteria, and then they administer the loan process and the administration of the loans themselves. So there is an extensive application process that has gone through to identify their financial situation and their efforts or the availability of other funding to them. If it's available to them otherwise, then they drop down in their overall priority ranking. If they are financially stressed, then they go up in their priority ranking.
I don't want to take follow up. Time. I just want to know who determines the financial ability, because that seems to be very broad and vague, and resource is limited. And who determines economic development, or do you?
Chair Winters, Senator Yee, we set the basic criteria. Economic development is the one that does that staff work.
So you set the standards for both health and financial ability?
We set the standard that financial ability is one which has to be demonstrated. Economic development is the one then who gathers that information and evaluates it.
So they make the determination.
Pardon?
They make the determination.
They make the determination, that's correct.
Financial ability.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Based on our criteria that that is one that needs to be met.
Will you give me a set of your standards?
Sure, we'd be very happy to do that.
Okay, moving on to page 86 under the essential packages. Those are basic adjustments that Mr. Fazier has already gone through. I would note that on package number 15, we are requesting reductions in the base budget to reflect inadequate current revenue in a couple of areas, one with restaurant inspections, one with pool and spa inspections. We're going to talk about restoring those, our request to restore those in a moment.
Grant, how many... direct restaurant inspections do you do now? How many are done by the county, counties?
Chair Winters, there are approximately, I think it's 2,600 facilities, food facilities, which we directly inspect in 12 counties.
12 counties. Is it that the counties just don't have the staff to do it, or did they just not, are they opted not to, and why?
Chair Winters, by statute, if a county wants to be what's called a delegate county for environmental health services, and we believe that they have the resources to do that, then they will become a delegate county. So the 24 counties that have elected to become delegate counties then have the same authority and responsibilities for environmental systems as we do in those 12 direct service counties.
And your fee structure, how is it comparable to the county's fee structure, like the fees?
Chair Winters, it is fairly comparable. Ours in the proposal is larger. The fees are slightly higher than in some of the counties. That is, I think, reflective of the fact that these 12 counties that we're talking about are basically the small rural counties of the eastern part of the state, where we have very high travel costs. That is, from, for example, the inspector's headquarters in LeGrand to some of his facilities in Lake County, the one-way trip is 314 miles. And as a result of that, he basically goes out for a week and spends... nights on the road, and as a result of greater distance of travel, having overnight expenses, our costs of doing business in that part of the state are substantially greater than, say, for example, here in Marion County or Multnomah County or Washington County, where there are no overnights, where they can basically park the car and get five or six inspections in one setting.
How frequently are they inspected?
Chair Winters, they are inspected twice per year.
Can you give me, and I know that distance and travel is some of the factors that are involved when you're looking at Eastern Oregon, a range of, and you don't have to do it, say, but send me a range of license fees across the state?
Certainly, we can do that.
Moving on to budget reductions on page 88, during this most recent budget cycle, we did have to put up the general fund portion of the drinking water program a little over $1 million as a potential cut. That cut was taken in the governor's recommended budget. However, as we've already discussed, that would have meant a loss in federal funds for the revolving fund loan program of $28 million to the state of Oregon, and consequently, in the governor's recommended budget, that $1.15 million has been backfilled with lottery dollars from Economic and Community Development Department. Looking at the enhancement packages, policy package 132, and there is a related fee bill, House Bill 2256, would increase the restaurant inspection fees. That's the program we were just talking about. We have worked over the interim and through the session with both local health departments and the Oregon Restaurant Association to come up with amendments to House Bill 2256 that everyone is now in agreement on. That bill has passed on the House committee and has been sent down to Ways and Means, and we're working with the co-chairs to try to get a hearing scheduled. Policy package 133, the pool and hot spot licensing fee increase bill, and the increase, and there is a related fee bill, House Bill 2242. This is a similar
question. I want to go back, because one of your in your enhancement package, decreasing the number of persons becoming ill because of foodborne illnesses. Currently, what was the outbreak in the state? Among the rest, because this is directly the linked, I guess, to the Restaurant Association. What was the illness outbreak in the last biennium?
And Chair Winters, I'm not sure exactly what the question was. There have been some hepatitis A outbreaks. There recently was a E. coli outbreak in Marion County.
Yeah.
And that was the most recent one that received a number of media attention.
Could you give us, because this is one of your performance outcome measures or your statement, can you give us some information longitudinal on the number of outbreaks across the state and show how they've either gone up or down?
Chair Winters, we certainly can. What time period would you like to see that for? The last 10 years?
That'd be good.
Okay, we'll do.
And are you planning any public program to, we talked about this earlier, about actually the biggest education and training needs to be of the public in dealing with cross-contamination and some of those foodborne illnesses. And is there anything that the division is planning?
Chair Winters, that is something that we would like to be working on over the interim. There are not specific dollars for that, as there are through fees for
yeah,
a program like this.
But
that is something that that I agree we need to be working on and will over the interim. So moving back to the pool and spa licensing fee increase, this is a program that has not seen a fee increase for 18 years. This is something where, again, we inspect pools and spas every year to ensure that they are in compliance both with physical standards and that they're doing the monitoring the way that they should be.
And I like the same kind of outcome data information for that.
In the way of water?
Decreasing the number of illnesses transmitted through pool water.
Right.
What's been the history?
The big issue for us on this particular program is because we have not seen a fee increase in 18 years, we have gotten to the point now where we simply cannot do the statutorily required number of inspections with the current fees that we are receiving. And if we do not get a fee increase this session, we're feeling that the only alternative is for us to have fewer inspections done in those facilities.
But Grant, you should have reporting from somewhere if there's illnesses that are a result of pools. Doesn't that come to you somehow?
Right. And Chair Winters, we will get that information to you like we will for the foodborne outbreaks as well. On page 90, policy package 135 is outpatient dialysis facility licensure, and there is a related bill, House Bill 2241. Over the last few years, we have been seeing a substantial increase in the number of complaints about outpatient dialysis facilities, and unfortunately, when we've gone to investigate those complaints, a high number of them have been founded complaints that have shown, in some cases, very serious problems with the facilities. Consequently, over the last interim, we worked with the industry to develop this bill, which would provide for annual inspections and licensing of outpatient dialysis facilities. The industry is supportive of this bill, and House Bill 2241 has passed both chambers and should be coming to the committee.
Do you inspect not only the outpatient but the hospitals as well?
Chair Winters, yes, we do. And if there are dialysis facilities in a hospital, then that is part of that inspection program. And with that finishes the discussion on the Center for Environmental Health and Systems, unless there's further questions for myself and Mr. Johnson on that. And if not, we'll move into the Center for Child and Family Health, and I would ask Donald Dodson, who is the director for that center, to come and join me. This center administers programs directed at improving the overall health of Oregon's women, children, and families. This is a population that for a number of years has been recognized to be a more vulnerable population and deserves some special attention. We collect and share data, we develop and implement public policy, we provide services to that population, and that's primarily by providing technical assistance, consultation, and resources to local health departments and other community partners. As you can see on page 92, the Center for Child and Family Health is composed of seven sections: maternal and child health services team, the women and reproductive health team, dental health, perinatal and child health, adolescent health, immunization section, and the WIC program. And again, we're just going to go over a couple of program areas here. The first is immunization. We've actually talked quite a bit about immunization already. What we are trying to do is provide leadership to prevent vaccine-preventable disease for all people in Oregon, with a particular focus on children. While our immunization rates are not as high as we would like to see them, and that has been discussed by the committee, we do feel that we have been successful, and right now a number of the vaccine preventable diseases are at or near all-time lows. We continue to provide surveillance and outbreak control for this population. We also, I think, can point to a number of recent accomplishments, and they are on page 95. We have implemented an award-winning, fully operational statewide registry called the Immunization Alert. One reason it is so successful is that 85% of private providers giving immunization are participating in this program, and over 90% of all preschool children have immunization data in that alert registry. Also, over the biennium, we have implemented new child care and kindergarten requirements for varicella vaccine. We've implemented new adolescent immunization requirements for all seventh graders, as well as implemented new recommendations for hepatitis A and pneumococcal conjugate vaccine for children. And we have distributed over $10 million of vaccine in the calendar year 2000 to public and private providers, both through our 317 program and Vaccine for Children program. I mentioned the registry immunization alert already. One of the issues for that has been the need for stable long-term funding. Up until now, we have had what I think is a very creative, innovative public-private partnership, where actually the private side is paying for more than half of the ongoing operating costs of immunization alert. That is something that the private side has agreed to continue for a number, another 2 years. They're providing $350,000 per year for the next 2 years for immunization alert. However, they have notified us that they do believe that to find a stable funding source for the registry is an important thing to do, and have asked us to bring that up, to work on that over the interim and bring that up to the next legislative session. Are there any questions, further questions on immunization? And if not, I will move into genetics. This is an area that really is very much a developmental area for us, but it is a critical emerging issue. The area of genetics is one where the technology is really advancing this field tremendously in the field of medicine, and it has a number of public health implications as well. And one of the concerns that I and other people have is that the technology here is moving so quickly that it's very possible that the technology can actually push the policy rather than the policy developed that will reflect good policy around genetics. There are a number of issues we think are important for public health in the area of genetics. They include making sure that genetic services are available, educating the public, and training healthcare providers about genetic issues, collecting and analyzing genetic health data, making sure that we are developing good policy, and to come up with all of these things, we need to do a comprehensive need assessment on where we are around genetic health issues in Oregon. In the summer of 2000, the health division did receive a 2-year maternal and child health grant to get working on this. And basically, what that grant will allow us to do is to develop a 5-year state public health genetics plan, and then develop a plan for incorporating genetics health data into the integrated data system that we're currently developing. Our work in the area of genetics will require us to work with a number of partners, including a number of the centers within the health division, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, OMAP, our Medicaid agency, genetic services providers, that includes healthcare providers that are involved in genetic services, and of course consumers and advocacy agencies would be important to be involved as well. Two of the primary issues in genetics that we'll be looking at is newborn screening. There are a number of newborn conditions where new technology can detect children with disorders. However, that is only going to be worthwhile if there is treatment and intervention services available for those children. So the whole issue of what diseases to test for and what services to provide is something we need to look into. And also another critically important issue is that of genetic privacy. As I said, the technology here can drive the policy rather than the other way around, and we need to make sure that there are good policies in place early on to protect the privacy of individuals. Moving on, page 102 gives the performance measures and benchmarks that the Center for Child and Family Health works towards. There are a number of those. I would note that there is one error on benchmark 54. It should be decrease the percentage of Oregons without insurance rather than increase. On page 103 in the central packages, again, most of those are issues that Mr. Fazier has already gone through in those packages 10 through 50. However, I would mention in 50 that at the time our budget was being developed, the money from the private side for immunization alert had not been guaranteed. And consequently, it was not reflected in the budget. So we have a $700,000 expenditure limitation that we need to buy back, and we need to do that either through that package 50 or through a separate policy package, which I believe is policy package number 142. Looking on page 104, going through the budget reductions, there are a number of budget reductions that were proposed and accepted from this center. School-based health centers being the biggest one. That's a $2.5 million program. We provide core funding for about 20 school-based health centers across the state, and provide, I believe it is, about half of the funding for those centers. As you heard, in addition to the 20 that we fund, there are 24 4 additional centers across the state that are totally funded from either local or other funds. The failure of us to be able to fund the centers that we're currently providing funding for will likely result in the closure of some centers, as was testified to by Jackson County, where they said 5 out of the 7 centers they believed would close without that funding. Another budget reduction in this center is for the state perinatal project, which is a contract that we have with OHSU to provide medical consultation and education provided, and also to provide some direct services, particularly in rural areas. That was a basically $400,000 funding grant that we gave to the Department of OBGYN at OHSU. General funds for home visiting services, as we have discussed before, were transferred to the Commission on Children and Families for the Oregon Children's Plan. However, our understanding that those dollars are going to be coming back. We also had general funds for a teen health information line eliminated, and that was about $100,000. So for this center, all of the
question: what's the reason that those funds are coming back?
Chair Winters, my understanding was that deals had been made around the Oregon Children's Plan so that the money that was in Babies First and then was going to be transferred to a blended system is now coming back, because there is going to be a Babies First program continue to be identified within the health division.
What does that do with the coordination linkage and the service to the population, if it's not a part of the bigger picture?
Right, and Chair Winters, my understanding is that it is a part of the bigger picture, that we are still looking at a fully coordinated Oregon Children's Plan, and that while the funding streams are going to remain separate the way that they have been in the past, that there is going to be a requirement that Babies First coordinate with Healthy Start and other providers, and that Healthy Start coordinate with Babies First and other providers. So from my perspective, it doesn't matter how the dollars flow as long as there's that coordination, and we will work hard to make sure
that... This wasn't a placeholder issue.
Chair Winters, not my understanding.
Representative Carlson, do you have anything to add? Okay.
I was just going to close on this by saying that all the reduction items that were submitted to the governor from Child and Family Health were accepted. And in enhancement packages... basically, we're just talking about position reclassification or adjustments. And that is the end on Child and Family Health, unless there are further questions. And one thing that we had been asked by Senator Yee to provide was a flow diagram talking about how women get into the public health services system and then how they are identified as potentially having alcohol and drug abuse problems and how they then are referred to services, and that is now being passed out. Okay, on page 108, we are down to the last section that we're going to talk about, which is the Office of the Administrator. And the Office of the Administrator develops policy and basically provides the overall management and oversight for the division. As I think we've discussed before, the actual a lot of the actual administrative business-like services are provided by the Department of Human Services centrally and are dealt with in their budget presentation. What we do is set overall policy and management direction for the health division, and we also provide statewide direction for public health in partnership with the Conference of Local Health Officials. In addition to that general work, we also have a number of what we called cross-agency and special programs, and these are programs that do have implications for all of the centers and consequently are in the administrator's office rather than in an individual center. And those include multicultural health, plans review, certificate of need, health partnerships, community services, indigent burial, and health education and information, which is primarily our communications media work, which we actually have quite a lot of.
Again, I'm just going to talk about a couple of areas here. The first is the Office for Health Partnerships. We have for many, many years had what we called a community services section, and their primary role is to be the link with local health departments and community-based organizations. However, another function that they have had is to be what is called the primary care office, which is a grant through the federal government where we do health manpower shortage area designations, and also work closely with the Office of Rural Health, the Office of Primary, the Oregon Primary Care Association, the area health education centers, and other groups to help to ensure that there is access in rural areas for people who need health care, and to make sure that there are adequately trained people in those areas. And about 2 years ago, the executive team at the health division felt that it was important to raise the visibility of this function and actually to expand the work of this function so that it was really developing partnerships with our key players, not only rural health and the AHEC office, but also with closer ties with the Medicaid office, with the Office of Health Plan Partnerships, with professional organizations and others. And consequently, we didn't actually expand the number of people there, but we did elevate the level of one person to a management person to take on these tasks. And we think that we have had some successes over the biennium here. We have been instrumental in working with the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research to get a comprehensive access grant from HRSA. We have also worked closely with the Oregon Primary Care Association and Multnomah County to get another HRSA grant that is going to be supporting a community health information network for safety net clinics. The other area that I wanted to discuss briefly, and actually one that we have talked about some already, is the Office of Multicultural Health. And the Office of Multicultural Health, really, as I see it, has three main functions. One is to work closely with multicultural communities to be our eyes and ears out in the field, and to bring that information back to us, as well as to get information out. Another second responsibility is to help provide to the different centers and programs within the division a multicultural perspective so that their programs reflect those concerns and needs. And then thirdly, to be working on workforce issues so that we can have a more diverse and culturally competent workforce in the near future. One of the important things that this office has been working on over the last biennium was being a primary supporter for the governor's task force on racial and ethnic health, and we have already discussed the six priority areas that group came up with in the report. I would also mention that over the next biennium, one of the key things that we will be working on with this office is to support the recommendations that did come out of that report. On page 115 on the essential packages, again, packages 10, 20, and 30 basically reflect adjustments. And in budget reductions on page 117, there were no reductions offered up by the administrator's office, and so none taken by the governor. On page 118, in enhancement program packages, policy package 90 is the package that will provide some money, approximately $500,000, to help move forward the recommendations made by the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. We have discussed this already, but basically it's going to be work in three areas: enhanced data collection and analysis, improved monitoring of racial and ethnic health force task force recommendations, and then some seed money for to fund community-based projects.
Grant, if you didn't receive the $500,000, is there some way you can absorb some of this within inside of your agency?
Chair Wenders, I mean, we're already doing work with our Office of Multicultural Health, and would continue to do that work.
However, I don't see how we could move forward on those three specific, and we would be able to do some around the monitoring of the recommendations, but I don't see how we could do additional data collection, and there would be no seed money for the community projects. I'd also mention that while it was $500,000 that was being proposed for this, we would use that money to leverage whatever other federal dollars we could and think that we could be very successful in using that dollar to get additional federal dollars.
Speaking of federal dollars, do you have a grantsman on your staff?
Chairman, pardon me?
Do you have a grantsman or grants person on your staff?
Chair Winters, we do not. Grants are written by the program people themselves. That is something that we have considered. It's something in the past that we had a
I'm not encouraging you. I just I asked that.
But we do not.
Because of I asked for a list of how many federal, you know, you have a lot of federal grants, and so I just wondered if you had a grants manager on your staff, someone who tracks and keeps in contact with the federal government to know when things are coming down the pike.
And Chair Winters, we don't. The individual program areas, you know, find those things out for themselves, write the grants, and then have their own grant managers within their center. Policy packages 168 and 178 are, again, basically reclassifications and adjustments. And so moving to page 120 on budget notes, there were three budget notes for the health division that came out of last session. One was around the division's teen pregnancy prevention advertising program, and $131 was held for the emergency board, and we could not spend that until we got approval from the e-board that the advertising campaign was appropriate. Similarly, for the students today aren't ready for sex, the STARS abstinence-based program, last session the $151,000 of general fund was held by the emergency board until there was going to be the development of alternative programs, alternative abstinence programs that would allow counties a menu of programs to choose from simply rather than simply having to do the STARS program. In December of 1999, with the rebalance plan, both the advertising program for teen pregnancy prevention and the STARS program were moved from the health division to AFS, and I believe that AFS has dealt with those budget note items in their presentation to you. The third budget item was that the subcommittee directed the health division to include in its rebalance plan the abolishment of a minimum of four positions in addition to the eight abolished in the recommended budget, and in the December 1999 rebalance plan that was accomplished. And then the final page in the presentation deals with performance audits, and there were two that were conducted over the interim. One of them, which we have discussed already, was the Secretary of State's audit on the drinking water program. And the audit recommended that mandatory test reporting by water laboratories to both division and the water system would improve our ability to promptly identify potential water safety problems. At the current time, water systems can have laboratories, voluntarily can have laboratories report to us directly. That is not a requirement. And then the other major recommendation was that they said that we need to increase the use of our enforcement powers authorized to the division for water quality issues. The State Audit Division did believe that we were carrying out our responsibilities to the best of our availability within available resources, and resources is the real issue here, that it is will be very difficult for us to do more in the way of enforcement without having additional dollars. They would cost substantial dollars. Those are not in the governor's recommended budget. I believe that the committee has received a letter from the federal, actually the regional EPA office, suggesting that in the future more state dollars do be spent on the water program. And that is something that we have agreed to work on over the interim and bring back as a legislative concept next session.
Senator Shield.
I don't want to interrupt until he finishes.
Okay.
I have one thing I'd like to return to as soon as he's done.
And then the final thing is that there was a Secretary of State's audit conducted on a change of administrator since Eleanor Hall, the previous administrator, left a couple of years ago, and I believe that the findings from that are presented by the Department of Human Services. And with that, I'm done.
Madam Chair, I want to apologize. I was just pulled into a meeting with some folks from the Oregon Law Commission, and so I missed a presentation or your part of your presentation that dealt with WIC. And I just want to raise that because three different speakers of the House, all Republican and one Senate president, have appointed me to the Hunger Relief Task Force. One of our priorities, of course, is using the farmers market to help women and children and so on. And I just really wanted, you know, like when you've got folks like Representative Schrader that keep an eye on the farmers and their well-being, how much does WIC do in terms of maybe there's some farmers out there that, I mean, we've all heard how much need there is for the food, for the women and the infants, the children, but what can we do to enhance that program, and are there benefits that are both for the farmers out there as well as the... can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, Chairwinder, Senator Shields, the WIC program, as we have discussed earlier, is a huge program. It's a major program in the health division. It is a nutrition program that provides nutrition counseling and education, as well as primarily food vouchers, and most of the money in WIC for food goes out in the way of food vouchers. However, over the last 4 or 5 years, we have been developing a WIC farmer market program where actually they can use the vouchers to buy fresh fruits and vegetables at farmers market. And we do see this as a real win-win for everybody. It's a win for the clients who are getting very good nutritional fresh fruits and vegetables. It's a win for the farmers because they're being supplemented with that additional income as well. That's something that we would like to see grow, however, is dependent on money. Another innovative thing that has just happened in the last couple of years is the extension of a seniors farmers market through the WIC program as well.
Madam Chair, one follow-up question, and that is, I've heard that we actually have to return federal money because we just can't come up with the match for the WIC farmers market. Is that... What's happening there?
Chair Winters, Representative Shields, or Senator Shields, I'm sorry.
Whatever.
That is true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Denelda Dodson with the Health Division. The federal government says that in order to do the WIC Farmers Market, we have to have a 30% local state match. We currently have $100,000 a biennium for that match. So that does inhibit our ability to draw down more federal funds. And in the last couple of years, we have been asked each time, could you take more federal dollars? And we have been had to say no, we could not, because we could not come up with a match. We used in-kind match. The farmers markets themselves, their market directors, we count that as in-kind. But the limited state dollars that we have to draw down the federal dollars prohibits us from expanding that.
So right now...
we're maxed.
Yeah, but it's a 30, you come up with 30% and they come up with 70%. And if we could come up, if there was any way we could get more money, how much more could we get?
Chair Winters, Senator Shields, in the past we have been asked if we could take $200,000 more or as much as we could take. And we have had to say no.
Question, because you mentioned in-kind. As well as hard cash.
Yes.
What local agencies are you working with to assist you in delivering this program that could be your in-kind source or your pool?
Chair Winters, we use local health departments and a couple of the tribal agencies, and the money that they have for WIC is federal funds, and so they do provide the direct service to the client, but the dollars that we need are to match the food dollars that come in so that those food dollars could go out to the farmer.
Might I suggest, because the Community Action Agency is a part of Housing and Community Services, which is one vehicle that I know that is connected to the community that may be able to assist in the issue of
of in-kind contribution, since you can do both. And since you're linking with housing and community development, other, and they're also a part of the hunger task force and some of those other issues, that you may want to forge that kind of a linkage on this particular issue here to try to engage as much as well as in-kind dollars as possible. I didn't know that in-kind was available under this, and that's another good source.
Madam Chair.
Match dollars, yeah.
The NOUTA just triggered something in my mind, and I'm just going to say it on the record and see what you think. She mentioned tribal organizations, too. What if, for instance, a tribe came up with $10,000?
Wonderful.
Can that get included as part of a state match and therefore leverage federal funds?
I really would have to ask Zanelda that, but I my assumption is that, and Zanelda can correct me if I'm wrong, once the federal government allows you to have both in-kind as well as hard dollars, that your source then, they can use community source or any other source as their matching ability. So to me, they have a wide open, if you for all practical purposes, a way of generating the matches, whether it's tribal or whether it's you donating your time to do something that also counts as in-kind, as long as it's a part of getting the persons or persons to where they need to be, and or even the farmer, if the farmer isn't paid, becomes an in-kind match.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say I'd like to pursue this as aggressively as I can, because not only do the poor folks win, but I understand that some farmers actually plan a little bit extra and so on in anticipation of the WIC program. So, you know, I would think both sides in this legislature would be interested, both from the farming end and from the, I mean, we talk about foreign competition and the farmers having a tough time these days. Well, this is all local stuff, local fruits and vegetables.
Grant.
And Chair Winters, I would just close by talking a little bit about the handouts. A couple of things that were asked for. One was a vacancy factor report, which I will give to people today. Another thing was the one-pager on performance measures, which I will also provide today. I apologize. There's a couple other things on tobacco. A letter of intent to the Tobacco Evaluation Advisory Committee asking for them to give us advice on how we can look at individual components of the tobacco prevention education program effectiveness, and also some breakdown of the tobacco statistics and other things. I failed to bring those today, but I'll get them to you tomorrow. The one outstanding item that I know of is the fishbone diagram that Representative Carlson had asked for, which was to help people see how we relate to other organizations and agencies in the community, and that we are still working on, and we'll get to you as quickly as possible. And that is the end of my presentation, and I, again, would like to thank the committee very much.
I thought we were going to end at 9 o'clock, and now it is after. That's because I was really with the Chronologically Advantaged group this morning. But thank you for your presentation. There's no further questions. You have time to get to your offices before you get to the floor. Yeah. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.